Our Father, God, we call you Adonai. We call you Lord, and then though we recognize that we are people who are prone to wander, we are a people who call you Lord, but then we don't always do what you say. Other things capture our mind's eye, our attention, and we're all too often faithless or unfaithful, but you, as we've been reminded this morning, you are Lord over it all. You are Adonai over it all, and you are the faithful one who in and by your relentless grace continues to pursue us, to call us back home to you. We thank you that you have revealed this truth about yourself in your word, and so as we open it this morning, would you continue to show us more of who you are and allow our hearts to be captured by more of you and more of your relentless grace, we ask in Jesus' name, amen. Good morning. How are you? How was your fourth? Good, all right. No accidents with fireworks or anything? All right, well, that's good. That's good. You know, there's a huge interest in spirituality today. There's a hunger in the human heart for something to make sense of the mess that we see in the world, something to make sense of the mess in us, something, there's a hunger for something transcendent that would be life-transforming. And there are no shortage of spiritual teachers out there who write and speak on the subject of how the spiritual hunger can be satisfied and how we can make these transforming connections in our lives. All you have to do is walk through a Barnes and Nobles and you can see that. One such teacher who has several books currently on the New York Times bestseller list and who has been endorsed by a prominent afternoon talk show host and her book club puts it this way. This writer says, throughout history, there have always been rare individuals who experienced a shift in consciousness and so realized within themselves that toward which all religions point. He basically believes all religions teach the same thing, but real spiritual enlightenment comes from within yourself. And he goes on to say, unlike mainstream religion, their teachings, these rare individuals, of which he would be one, emphasized realization and inner transformation. And so this new spirituality, the transformation of consciousness, is arising to a large extent outside of the structures of existing institutionalized religion. He goes on to say that's partly as a result of the spiritual teachings that have arisen outside the established church, but also due to the influx of ancient Eastern wisdom teachings. A growing number of followers of traditional religion are able to let go of identification with form and dogma and rigid belief systems and discover the original depth that's hidden within their own spiritual tradition. And at the same time, they discover the depth within themselves. They realize that how spiritual you are has nothing to do with what you believe, but everything to do with your state of consciousness. Now, this teaching is extremely popular today, and if you pay attention, if you spend some time at the pool or at the beach this summer, or you travel and you go through an airport, you see people reading books. You don't even have to travel, just at coffee breaks, at lunch. At work, you see people reading these books, taking all this in, and over the last month or so, I've had around a dozen talks with Christ followers who are reading all this stuff and thinking that Christianity can blend pretty well with it, like the author claims that it does. But what you need to understand that according to the Bible, spirituality and connecting with God and inner transformation and encountering transcendence, all of that is very much offered to you, but the Bible makes it abundantly clear that spiritual experiences come from outside yourself. They come from revelation, from truth with a capital T, truth that is not resident within us, but truth that has to be revealed to us. And the amazing thing is, it's not our search for God, but His search for us that gets us there. And I want to talk about that this morning. So take your Bible and turn with us to Genesis chapter 28. If you're just joining us, we're studying the story of a man named Jacob, a man who both Led Zeppelin and U2 wrote songs about. So he's a very important man. Actually, he's one of the founding fathers of the faith. People today still talk about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God will eventually change his name to Israel, so he becomes the father of the nation of Israel, a very important man in the line of promise that ultimately leads to Jesus, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Actually, as we've seen over the last 3 weeks, though, Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and neither of them make good candidates for the founding father of a new religion. I mean, Esau, the oldest son, he's got red hair all over his body. He's a manly man, hunts, fishes, always has a dip in, drives an F-150, would have loved that Mellencamp song. He's got the whole Toby Keith collection. He loves wrestling on TV. He's kind of a thug. He's got three wives who all have part-time jobs at Hooters, and He doesn't really care about God's promises or God's priorities. He's just not a great guy. But on the other hand, you've got Jacob, and Jacob is a total mama's boy. I mean, drives a cabriolet, wears pastels, stood in line all night to get the new Mariah Carey album. Doesn't like conflict, but conflict follows him all of his life. Not a very manly man. And he's a crook. He's a con man. From the very beginning of this story, the writer makes no attempt to hide the fact that Jacob will do whatever it takes to get what Jacob wants. And he wants to be first and favored. And as far as Jacob is concerned, you are responsible for you. You shape your destiny. You make things happen. You leave nothing to chance. And so you've got Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Esau. Not great choices. It's like, do you want a Hyundai or a Daewoo? And just like, well, neither. I think I'll walk. But This is what God has to work with. And before these two boys are born, though, God had chosen Jacob, the younger son, to be in the line of promise, the promise bearer, the one through whom would come a new humanity, the nation of Israel, through which God's blessing would eventually come to the world in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, we pick up the story in chapter 28, verse 10. Jacob is about 77 years old, and he's done nothing with his life. I mean, all he's good at is lying and stealing, and he's in his 70s, and he's still living with his parents, has no wife, no kids, no responsibility. He doesn't seem to care. His mother looks after him, tells him what to do. And if you're still living at home when you're 70 and your mom's microwaving your burritos and washing your clothes, you know, that's a real classic case of failure to launch. So, as I said, this guy is going to become the father of the nation of Israel. He's going to become a man of faith. So the question is how? How is God going to get this boy who grew up in a believing home, who grew up with imperfect but believing parents, who turned out to be a lying, cheating, scheming mama's boy, how is God going to change Jacob into Israel? I mean, he certainly needs inner transformation, but how's it going to happen? And that's what we're going to look at this morning, how God changes Jacob and also how God works to change us. And what we're going to see is that life change doesn't come from inside. It doesn't come from relying on your parents' faith, and it doesn't come from just believing in God. There was an article in New York Times Magazine sometime after 9/11. It was talking about how people are asking more questions about religion and all things spiritual. And at one place in the article, it was a very interesting quote. The woman who was writing this article claimed to be an agnostic, but she said something like this. She said, "At times like this, I almost wish I did believe in God, because at times like this, you need something more than Starbucks and Barnes and Noble to get you through it." She said, "I wish I could believe in God. I think that would help me through it." But she's wrong. Because you see, Jacob believed in God, but that wasn't enough to get him through the disasters of his life. He knew about God from the faith of his grandfather Abraham and his father Isaac. He knew about God from his family's faith, But there's nothing we've seen so far in the story that would tell us that Jacob has a personal faith or that he was a viable candidate for the awakening of his inner consciousness. So, you know, in order to come to know God personally, he needs to understand how a real relationship with God works. And that's what we're going to look at. Chapter 28, verse 10, just the first couple of words, Jacob left Beersheba. Why did he leave home? Remember the story? Because with his mother's help, he dressed up in his brother Esau's clothes, went into his blind old father who thought he was dying, and Jacob deceived his dad into giving him the blessing of the oldest son. Now, God had promised that Jacob would get the blessing even before he and his brother were born, but Jacob was the kind of man that would not leave things to chance. He's going to make things happen, and he pulls off the scam, but it backfires because just as Jacob leaves, Esau walks in, finds out what happened, and Esau vows to kill Jacob as soon as his father Isaac is dead. And so Rebekah, his mom, comes up with another plan. You know, jump in your cabriolet, drive far, far away to your uncle Laban's house in a city called Haran. So verse 10, Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and he stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to fall asleep. Now, you got to pay attention. Now, that just sounds just like background, but you got to pay attention to the details, small little details that paint the picture the way we need to understand it. The text says he came to a certain place. It's referred to as just a place six times in this passage. Later, we will learn that it used to be a place called Luz, which commentators say means deceit. So he's probably camping out in the ruins of Luz. The deceiver is camping out in the ruins of deceit. Isn't that interesting? It was a no-name place, though, at this time, and it's the narrator's way of saying he's out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, Jacob is a real nowhere man, sitting in a nowhere land, making his nowhere plans for nobody. I've heard that before. Anyway, and we're told, second thing, he used a stone for a pillow. How many of you, when you travel, take your pillow with you? Yeah, a lot more of you do than that. I know that. Why would you use a stone for a pillow? It's the narrator's way of saying he was penniless. He had nothing. I mean, if you had a sack of clothes with you, you would roll that up and you would use it as a pillow. If you had a bag of grain, you would use that as a pillow. So to say that he was using a stone for a pillow means he's out in the middle of nowhere with nothing. His life has completely fallen apart. And then there's this little line. I think it has double meaning. The artist is painting a picture and it says the sun had set. The sun had set. In other words, the sun had set on Jacob. Because he's not just in a nowhere place, he's in a nowhere place as far as God is concerned. God himself to Jacob is very distant and remote. I mean, what about the promise that he would be the head of the clan? What about the promise that he would inherit all that belonged to his father? What about the promise that God would bless him? It's all gone. In every other generation, Abraham didn't just believe in God. Abraham encountered God. Sarah didn't just believe in God. Sarah, Abraham's wife, encountered God personally. Isaac had a personal encounter with God. Rebekah received a personal prophetic oracle from God. And one of the most important themes running through the book of Genesis and all through the Bible, it's not just enough to know about God, you have to know God. It's not just enough to believe in God, you have to believe Him. It's not enough to rely on your parents' faith, you need your own personal faith, your own personal encounter. And what we see here is that if Jacob had never had an encounter with God before now, then common sense tells you it won't be now. Not after all the lying and cheating and stealing that he's done. It's true. The sun is set on Jacob. He's lost. He's lost to his family. He's lost in the wilderness. He's lost to God, or so it would seem, verse 12. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it, and the Lord stood above it. Now again, we got to look at the details. In this dream, Jacob saw three things. First, he saw a ladder, not the best translation. This was not like a painter's ladder that only one person can go up and down at a time. It's the Hebrew word is a ramp or a stairway. And the implication is that what Jacob saw was something huge, and it stretched from earth to heaven. It wasn't resting on a cloud. It was like a portal was open to another realm, a portal through which this stairway extended from one dimension to the other. The bottom touched the earth. The top went through the portal into heaven. And on this stairway, the second thing he saw was these angels going up and down, hundreds of angels going back and forth between these two worlds. Now, when you think of angels, don't think of Hallmark cards with little Cupid baby things or these old oil paintings with fairy-faced angels with big wings and blonde hair and all this kind of stuff. Not the angels on TV who just show up and say, hi. In the Bible, when you see an angel, the first thing the angel says is, fear not. So there must have been something awesome and frightening about the appearance of an angel. And the Bible tells us that angels are royal messengers from God, ministering spirits who come from God into the world to carry out God's work. And we're going to talk more about this in a minute, but the angels ascending and descending means that God's power is on the move, that his work is being carried out. In other words, I love this, there is traffic between heaven and earth. Heaven is not some remote, self-contained realm of the gods. Heaven has to do with earth. And there's traffic between heaven and earth. So Jacob sees a stairway full of angels carrying out the work of God. And the third thing that he sees, it says in verse 13, is that the Lord stood above it. Again, not the best translation. Most commentators agree that it means God was standing, the Lord was standing above him. Not at the top of the stairway, but God had come down the stairway and was standing over him. This becomes even more clear when God appears to Jacob a second time in Genesis chapter 35. It says that the Lord went up from him. So the picture you need to have in your mind when you think of this story is that Jacob falls asleep. He dreams that a portal opens in the night sky, a huge staircase extends through the portal, stretching down to the earth, uniting heaven and earth, and there are hundreds, maybe thousands of angels ascending and descending the staircase, carrying out the work of God, and he sees that God has come down the staircase and is standing over him like a mother watches over a sleeping child. That's the picture you need to have in your mind, and God speaks to Jacob exactly what he needs to hear. Verse 13, and behold, the Lord stood above him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. And the very land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread out abroad to the west and the east and the north and the south. And in you and in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, if you've been reading the story of Genesis so far, you know that's the Abrahamic blessing. That is God binding himself to Jacob to be his God, just like he was the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. God is confirming that the line of blessing, which will eventually lead to Jesus, that line of blessing is passing from his family to him. It's an invitation to personal faith. But look how personal God is in these next three promises. Behold, God says, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done what I promised. God promises three things. Again, exactly what Jacob needs to hear. First of all, at this point, Jacob is alone and friendless, and God says, I'll be with you. Second, he's utterly defenseless. He's a fugitive running for his life, probably looking back over his shoulder the whole time, wondering if Esau is that little cloud of dust back in the background coming after him. He's running for his life into uncertainty in a treacherous wilderness. God says, I will keep you. I will protect you and provide for you. And he's also penniless. You see, his inheritance is back home in Beersheba, back in the land that he was leaving. And God says, I'm going to bring you back. And I'm going to give you everything I promised you. I'm going to give you the land. I'm going to bless you. I will do what I said that I will do. And nothing is going to stop me. And this is just absolutely amazing, because there's not one word of judgment, not one word of condemnation in what God has to say to this lying, stealing, deceitful man. What God says is 100% unconditional. No strings attached. God is saying, I'm going to do this for you. This had to be something that had never occurred to Jacob, that you could be given something without having to negotiate and barter and deceive in order to get. It's pure grace. I will be with you. I'll protect you. I'll provide for you wherever you go. I'll bring you back. You've got my presence, my protection, my provision, my promise. I will bring you home. Now, we need to let all this sink in before we go further, because this is blowing Jacob's worldview here. The way Jacob had a limited view of God and life and faith up until this point in time. As I said, Jacob believed in God. He was raised in a family that believed in God, but he lived his life like a lot of us. Like this is the real world, and this is all there is to it. I mean, sometimes after a worship service or after a marriage conference or after a retreat of some kind where people have kind of been on a spiritual high, they come and they go, well, back to the real world. Like this is all there is. No. So you see, the Bible's showing us that this isn't all there is. That there's something beyond the visible, that there is the invisible, there's something beyond the temporal, that there is the eternal. There's something beyond the material that is spiritual. This dream is telling us that behind and beyond all the things that happen in our life, God is present and he's working and he's involved. And he is everywhere. His kingship, his rulership is working itself out in the world, as verse 14 says, because he's working right now in Jacob's life so to be a blessing to Jacob, so that through Jacob, blessing can come to the whole earth through one of Jacob's descendants. This is very similar to the revelation that Elijah sees in 2 Kings chapter 6, where, if you remember the story, Elijah and his servant are in a tight spot, and they're in a besieged city, and the enemy's encamped all around him just waiting to pounce for the kill. And Elijah's just sitting there, and he's all calm and confident, and the servant is like just pulling his hair out and going, how can you be so calm at a time like this? And Elijah prays and says, God, show him. Open his eyes so he can see. And God opens his eyes and pulls back like to this other dimension. I feel like we should be playing a Twilight Zone song here, you know, but and he sees angels and chariots of fire all around him. There's more going on in your life than you realize. There's traffic between heaven and earth. And what the Bible is saying to us is, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. Let me put it this way. You're not always going to understand why things go so badly in your life and in this world, but it doesn't mean that God isn't working. And it's kind of neat to think about that behind the scenes of your life, that no matter where you are, no matter what you've done, no matter what's been going on in your life, God is at work, and his holy angels are in the background doing what needs to be done in you and through you and around you to carry out what God has purposed. That's a very, very important takeaway from this story. But the second thing we need to pause just for a moment before we go forward is to see that the God of the Bible is a God who seeks us. You see, Jacob, he's not looking for God, but God's looking for him. God is initiating the relationship. God is the one who pursues the relationship. See, I said at the beginning of this talk, we live in a culture that hungers for spiritual experiences. And so when we talk about dreams and angels and awakening to new realities about God and life and faith, I mean, man, everybody loves this stuff. But the problem is, many people who are very spiritually minded still don't know who God is. And spirituality without a knowledge of God can lead to demonology. You don't just get angels, you get demons. You don't just get spiritual experiences. You get all wrapped up and bound up in yourself, trying to find inner peace inside you. It's just not going to be there. Just all you have to do is ask Jacob. And the spiritual teachers, well-meaning as they are, believe that spiritual experiences and spiritual people are good, but who you think God is not really important. You simply need to seek the experience and the spiritual reality that is within you, and everything is okay. But that's not what Jacob gets here. He doesn't just have a supernatural experience. The most important thing that Jacob gets here is the knowledge of God and how God is seeking him. That's true all through the Bible. In the Bible, God is the most important thing, and out of a relationship with the one true and living God flow spiritual experiences. But you say, well, I'm not out where Jacob is. I want a spiritual experience. Okay, you say God is seeking me. I haven't had a dream, haven't seen vision, haven't had angels appear to me, hadn't had God appear to me making promises. So how does that happen? Hang on. We'll get there in a minute. But let's see first how Jacob responds to his encounter. Verse 16, then Jacob awoke from his sleep and he said, surely the Lord is in this place and I didn't know it. And he was afraid. And he said, how awesome. The word is actually dreadful. How fearsome, awesome, incredible is this place. This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Now, why would he use that phrase, the gate of heaven? The gate of heaven. What he's saying is, this is how the gate of heaven works. So where do we hear about the gate of heaven? Well, earlier in the book of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 11, a group of people get together and they build a tower. It's called the Tower of Babel. And Genesis 11:4 says the top of the Tower of Babel reached into the heavens. The same kind of phraseology we see here. And scholars tell us that the word Babel, the word Babylon in ancient Near Eastern language means the gate of heaven, the gate of the gods. And the reason Jacob said this is the stairway to heaven or the gate of heaven is because the Tower of Babel is like a ziggurat. A ziggurat was like a pyramid in a sense, but there were no rooms and chambers on the inside. All the ziggurat was like a man-made mountain, and people would ascend the steps, and on their way up, they would perform rites of purification and pray prayers and make sacrifices. They would ascend to the top where hopefully that they would have attracted the attention of the God to get the God's blessing. See, are you beginning to see a little why Jacob is so amazed and how shocked he is? Because you see, God is accommodating himself through a cultural image that Jacob understands, but God is radically altering what this image is. Because you see, every other religion, every other temple, every other stairway was a stairway to heaven, built by human beings so they could ascend to the gods. But this is a stairway from heaven. It's a stairway chosen by God, a stairway that God comes down. It's not a way to ascend up to God to get his blessing. It's a stairway that God comes down to give his blessing. And this is absolutely different from any other religion that was ever conceived and still is. I mean, Christianity is the only religion that says, no, you don't have to work your way up the ladder. God comes down the ladder. He's not at the top of the ladder saying, climb, hurry, faster, hell's hot. And climb harder, harder, harder. And by the way, I put a little grease on the ladder just to make it a little more challenging. How many of you remember the children's song, we are climbing Jacob's ladder, we are climbing Jacob's ladder? Heresy. Rubbish. Do not let your children sing it. Second verse, every round goes higher, higher. Every round goes higher, higher. No! Jacob was not going round and round higher and higher. God had come down to him. That's the whole point. That's what he gets. That's the way the gate of heaven works. By grace, God comes down to us. I mean, look at Jacob. I mean, I can understand Moses going up to Mount Sinai and saying, show me your glory, and God gives him a glimpse of glory. Or Abraham saying in Genesis 15, God, I just need some assurance that the promise that you're making me, that it's true. And so God says, okay, cut some animals in pieces, and I'll pass through the pieces. Like in every other place in the Bible where we see God coming and revealing something of himself to people, at least the people were looking for God. They were walking for God. They were asking to see God and to know God. But Jacob isn't repenting. He isn't crying out for help. He's absolutely undeserving. He's not seeking to God. He's not even talking to God. But God shows up with all his holy angels and speaks word, not of judgment and condemnation, but of peace and protection and provision and promise to Jacob. God is initiating a personal relationship with Jacob freely, graciously. The question is, how will he respond? Verse 18, so early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he put under his head and he set it up for a pillar, and he poured oil on the top of it, and he called the name of that place Bethel, because the name of the city that used to be there was Luz, deceit. So what's he doing? He's worshiping. He's setting up a memorial stone. You know, like, here I raise my Ebenezer. Remember that from the hymn? He's like, why are we singing about Ebenezer Scrooge? No, Ebenezer was a stone of remembrance. So he's setting up this pillar, and he pours oil on it as an act of worship and dedication, and then he makes a vow. Verse 20, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God, El Shaddai, God Almighty, will be with me and keep me in the way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord Yahweh, personal covenant name for God, will be my God, and the stone which I've set up shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I'll give a full tenth to you. Now, a lot of people take this vow of Jacob to be just another shrewd example of a guy trying to make a deal with God, because it says if and then. I don't take it that way at all. Now, Jacob's, he's a piece of work, and he's going to, for the next 20 years, he's going to learn humility through humiliation, so he's going to reap a lot of what he sowed. But I take it that this is a step of faith. Jacob has just seen God and his holy angels coming down. He's afraid. He's overwhelmed. He recognizes the presence of God, and he's overcome by this gracious promise. Notice, he repeats exactly what God has promised him. And I think it should be understood like this. Like, Jacob is on his face before God, and he says, oh, God, general name for God. If all this isn't just a dream, if you'll be with me, if you really will protect me and provide for me, if you'll bring me back home, oh God, if you'll do that for me, then Yahweh, the God of Abraham and Isaac, you, Yahweh, you will be my God, and like my grandfather before me, I'll give you a tenth of all that you give me. See, he's not bartering. In the Bible, a vow is not a contract. It's a pledge of relationship. And God's not requiring a tithe. There's no law here. That's just another act of worship that this is a wow vow. It's like what we do when we hear the gospel and we trust Christ and we say something like, oh God, if he suffered and died and rose from the grave to forgive my sin and give me eternal life, God, if you did that for me, then I'll take you at your word. I'll believe your promises. And I'll follow you the best way I know how. It's like the vow we make when we say, Charlie, take you Karen to be my lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, and I'll forsake all others, pledging myself to you. It's that kind of vow. And Jacob is saying, Lord, if you're committing yourself to me in this way, in the way that you say you are, then I will commit myself to you in return. Again, it's just the beginning. He has a lot to learn. For Jacob to become Israel, he's got a long way to go, just like the rest of us. But what an incredible story. A man running away from home runs into God. A nowhere place becomes a house of God. A stone pillow becomes an altar of worship. And a man who's lived his life through deception and self-effort has a personal encounter with God and learns what it means to receive grace. You say, well, but how does that work with us? I mean, what's all this have to do with us? I mean, we can hardly duplicate this. After all, it was God's initiative. Can't make this happen. You say, I can't look for it or seek it. It's got to come to me. So how does it work for us? Well, the answer comes many centuries later. In a short little passage, just write this down and just listen as I tell you the story. But this comes from John chapter 1, verses 43 to 51. It comes true in Jesus. There was a guy named Nathanael, and Nathanael had a friend named Philip. And one day, Philip came to Nathanael, and he said, Nathanael, we have found the Messiah, the one Moses and the prophets have spoken about. And the Messiah is Jesus of Nazareth. And Nathanael says, Nazareth, that nowhere place? This is literally what he's saying. Nothing good comes out of Nazareth. God can't come down in nowhere places. And Philip says, come and see for yourself. And so Philip and Nathanael approach Jesus. Jesus looks at Nathanael and he says, ah, there's an Israelite in whom there is no guile. What does that mean? He says, there's a son of Jacob in whom there's no deceit. Oh, wow. And Nathanael's like, yeah, all my friends tell me I'm a pretty honest guy. But how do you know me? And Jesus says, well, I saw you when you were under the fig tree. And Nathanael's eyes get as big as saucers. And he's like, you saw me under the fig tree? Now, I have no idea what Nathanael was doing under the fig tree. I mean, I don't know if he was with somebody or what he was doing, but here's the deal. Whatever Nathanael was doing under the fig tree was so private, so significant, that when Jesus said, I saw you under the fig tree, it blew his mind, and he said, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. So whatever it was, you're the one. Now listen what Jesus says next. Jesus says, you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree. I tell you, you'll see greater things than this. I tell you, you'll see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What's he saying? What is Jesus saying? Now listen. Jesus is saying, I'm the stairway Jacob saw. I'm the link between heaven and earth. I'm the gate of heaven. I'm the God of Jacob. Come down, and you will see, if you follow me, you'll see the work of God carried out in and through me. And this is the answer. This is the answer to why the stairway, the gate of heaven Jacob saw, worked completely different, in a completely different direction than every other religion. It works in the opposite direction from every other religion, including distortions of Christianity. You know why? Jesus doesn't say you'll see the angels of God descending to the Son of Man as if he's at the top of the stairway or the top of the ladder. Jesus says you'll see the angels going up and down on me. Every other religion or spiritual teaching has steps that you climb to God. The five pillars of Islam, the eightfold path of enlightenment of Buddhism, washing in the river Ganges and repeating the thousand names of God. Every other religion has, these are the steps. Climb as high as you can, and hopefully you'll meet God at the top if you get there. Is that what Jesus is saying? No, Jesus is saying, no, you'll see the angels ascending on me. I'm the stairway. He's the steps. Every other religion has a series of steps, which is what? It's what you do. It's what you do to get to God, but we have a who. We have a who. Heaven, the stairway to heaven for us is a who. It's Jesus. The blessing of Abraham, the blessing of Isaac and Jacob, it's come true in the person of Jesus. He fulfilled the requirements. He did the steps for us. He lived the life we should have lived. He died the death and took the penalty we should have taken. He did it. And the reason is that Jesus is saying this, he said, let me tell you what you're going to see if you understand who I really am. I didn't just come to found a religion. I didn't just come to be an example for you to follow. I didn't come to give you wisdom and wise teaching. He did that. But he's saying, I came to be the stairway. I came to be the stairway. I came to do the work for you, to take the steps for you. And I've come down, just like God did to Jacob, I've come down once and for all. I've come down to give you the blessing of spiritual life. And he's saying, only when you understand that I'm the link between heaven and earth, that I've opened up a portal, blown a hole open between heaven and earth, between visible and invisible, between temporal and eternal, material and spiritual. Only when you see that heaven and earth intersect over my dead and resurrected body, only then will heaven be open for you. You see, some of you here this morning and you know about God, but you've never had a personal encounter with God. You're raised in homes where your parents taught you about God, but it hasn't, you know your parents' faith, but it hasn't become personal faith. And you might believe in God, and you might believe in Christianity, and you might know enough facts to pass a Bible quiz. But heaven is still closed to you because you haven't had your own experience of God's love and forgiveness, and the sense that he's standing over you like a mother does over a sleeping child, offering you unconditional love and forgiveness. Some of you haven't experienced that. You know why? Because you think that Jesus points to the steps. You think that there are things you have to do and rules and rituals you have to follow. But he's saying, no, you don't, it's not rules and rituals to follow. It's a relationship. That's what I came to reveal to you. That God is in pursuit of you if you'll just open yourself up to him through me. You see, God reveals and then we respond. That's the pattern. That's the paradigm. God reveals himself and we by grace and we respond in faith. And spiritual life and vitality flows out of that relationship with him. Because he comes down, when you trust Christ, he comes down into you and he puts his very own spirit into you. God reveals, we respond. That was true of Jacob, and it's true for us because God has revealed who he is and what he's like in Jesus, and he offers you spirituality and inner transformation through relationship, not just some realization of an inner consciousness. And if you're dabbling with the inner consciousness stuff, let me ask you, why would you trade a personal relationship with Jesus for more steps, for a promise of some other stairway, whether the stairway goes up or goes in? Why would you trade Jesus for that? Why would you trade being found by God for the lostness of the wilderness of your own inner landscape? Today, right now, if you see that God has revealed himself to you in Jesus, and you see that he's the stairway to heaven, and because God has revealed himself once and for all in Jesus' death and resurrection, and he offers you forgiveness, and he offers you real spiritual life, if you see that, and you want it. You don't. This can be Bethel for you. There's nothing special about this place. Bethel could be in your car. It could be in your office. It can be in your back room. There's nothing special about this place. But it could become a special place if you see that God has come down and he's saying to you, I want a relationship with you. It's just like a marriage. He says, I take you to be mine. Will you take me to be yours? And you can pray something like this. Oh, God, if what you say is true, if Jesus has come down to save me from this wandering selfishness that I have, then I do want to know you personally. I know I don't deserve anything from you. But if all this is true, then I want to know you. And the best I know how, I want you to know I believe your promises of forgiveness in life, and I trust you to do for me what you say you'll do in and through Jesus. And so, yes, forgive my sin and give me this new life in your Spirit. It's just that real and that simple. And you don't even have to throw in the part about the tithe. That's pretty good. Would you bow with me for prayer? This is a story. It's a story of the Bible. All through the Bible, God comes down to us. He came down at creation. He came down to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He came down to Moses. He came down through the prophets. He came down through Jesus. He's come down through the Holy Spirit. And at the very end of the Bible, it says that heaven is going to come down to earth and God's going to make it all new. It's not about steps and stairways to heaven. It's about a relationship with Jesus. And it's not about looking back to your parents' faith. And it's not about looking in, but it's seeing that Jesus is the stairway. He unites in his body heaven and earth. And he said, if you'll just take me at my word, if you'll just trust me, all I have will be yours. So if that's what you want, just tell God in your own words, in your own way.